I want to start off by shifting us from Kandinsky and Ernst to Frank Lloyd Wright and Henry Moore. Notice that we are pursuing the same inquiry format that we have now for a year and a half. We take a pair of books as like a tuning fork, and we use them for 1 month, for 4 weeks. And then we move to another pair, a different tuning fork, a different square of attention, for another 4 weeks. And once we have done that 3 times in a row, we bunch those 3 squares into a set of 12, and we give it an indexing power of infinity by having a 13th lecture that's not in the set, but raises the set to a new level. Then on that new level, we begin with a pair of books as a tuning fork to set the tone of a new square of attention, which is followed by a second and followed by a third. And when we have a beginning, middle, and an end of squares of attention, we bunch that as a set of 12, archetypal number, 13th lecture interval to index it and raise it to another power. And on that new power level, we do this again. And we do this 4 times so that 4 sets of 12 with indexing intervals make a whole year as a square of attention. Now we have a very powerful form. Now we have a symbolic form, which is the annual cycle unified into a single form. And with that kind of a structure, men and women like us were able to transform out of the Stone Age into the symbolic age of civilizations. But we take it one step further. We take 2 of these annual cycles, 2 of these 52-week squares of attention, and put them together. We put them together so it's a double cycle. So whereas the square of symbolic civilization used to handle and transform the circle of nature, the double square transforms the double circle of infinity into a form which future civilization can handle and which is livable and workable and creatable by anyone who masters that particular form. This education is that form. It doesn't master the form from the outside, but from the inside, because the form is made by your doing of the education. Now, I usually don't talk this way, but you have to know that this is architecture on a very large scale. This form is good in any star system, in any galactic structure whatsoever, regardless of dimensionality. It's good for the next 15 billion years. It took a long time to get here. It's here. Enjoy it. Make use of it. So we come to a new square of attention. This square of attention is tuned by the pair Frank Lloyd Wright architecture and Henry Moore sculpture. Now, to some people, architecture and sculpture are linked only because they both end in U-R-E. Architecture, sculpture, and that somehow they rhyme, and that is about as far as they could go. We've seen with Kandinsky and Ernst that art is spectacularly conspicuous because it is the first time that the differential dynamic achieves form. But that a work of art is not an integral form, but is a differential form. The difference is that the experience in an integral mode leads to a point of realization. Integration ultimately leads to realization. Whereas the process of differentiation leads to further openness. If you were to mathematically plot integration as an abstract movement, it, in its culmination, optimally would always end in zero. Whereas differentiation, optimally, abstractly, would always end in infinity. One is 1, 0, the other is a double zero. It's very easy, rule of thumb. We're a little fuzzy on the good bad thing. It's bad to mistake zero for infinity, because the one is an implosion to a vanishing center, the other is an explosion to an unbounded openness. It's easy to mistake them because they are transposable one with the other in terms of reality. Any logical, any mathematical expression that functions with zero can function with infinity substituted for it, and the expression will still carry itself quite accurately. If you look at the most universal language yet developed by human beings, the universal language of calculus, it has two different forms. There's an integral calculus and a differential calculus. The one deals with the way that there is a relationship between zero and one. The other deals with the relationship of the way in which one and zero operate. There are infinite limitations that are real, that can be quantified, that can be found in between those two liminals, zero and one. That infinite range, which nevertheless can be specified exactly, is the field of archetypal intelligence. When we come to art, art as a differential form handles experience differently from the way in which an integral form handles it. There are two integral forms that we've dealt with. One is the body, the other is the mind. The body needs to pull nature together. The mind needs to pull language together to make it stick. The old way in which the early Greek philosophers used to teach is that they would draw these diagrams in the dust and then clench their fists and say, "Did you get it? Here are the diagrams. Here's the understanding of it. It resides in you." The movement of nature comes to a focus and an integration in your body. You feel it. Is your existence real to you? Are you here? Martin Luther, in his autobiography, called it, "Here I Stand." So there's a stance, there's a stasis, there's an existential oomph, and the body records that. So too the mind. The mind understands. The mind gets it. The idea comes into clarity. It comes into unity. It's there. One gets it. Both the body and the mind are integral forms, But a work of art is a differential form, and so it distributes experience radically different from the way in which the body or the mind record experience, distribute experience. A work of art, when it functions as art, continues to open up. It doesn't pull together and then that's it. It opens up and then it continues to open up and that's it. So that a differential form, if we were to use colloquial language, frees us in a renewable resonance forever. The old aesthetic way was that you could never exhaust talking about or experiencing a work of art. And one of the proofs was that if you look at a supposed work of art, a painting, a sculpture, architecture, music, if you can come to a point of exhausting it, where you're not interested in going any further with it, then it's not a work of art. It's a clever pastiche, it's an interesting object, it's a nice sketch, it's a model, it's somebody's idea, but it's not a work of art. That you could return to a work of art many times during the course of a long lifetime, and this work of art will be different. You can listen to the Jupiter Symphony of Mozart at 16, at 40, at 90, and it will have different facets which open up to you. A work of art is a differential form, and its operative energy is further openness. So too, the second differential form that we will come to at the end of this year is the cosmos. The cosmos itself, not the universe, but the omniverse. The cosmos is constantly evolving and changing and creating and is always ever new. It never has a defining boundary. Whereas an integral form always has some kind of boundary which gives centeredness. Whereas a differential form may have a quality of seeming centeredness, but when one looks at it, the center is not really there. What operates is what in astrophysics is called a barycenter. It's the supposed center, but it's not the actual center. And the barycenter is there because of a pair, a polarity, a complementarity, which mutually generate the supposed focus, which is nothing in itself, only the imputed focus of this generative, creative, complementarity pair. So that the boundaries of a differential form are always enlarging, changing, creating, exceeding what you thought they were, what you thought they could be, what anyone thought they were, what anyone thought they could be. A differential form is like the Taoist Tai Chi. An integral form is like the old Paleolithic star. The Paleolithic star are all the lines that come to a single center, and that single center is there by a dot. When one looks at the earliest catacombs, Christian catacombs under the city of Rome, when the Hellenistic Jewish cosmic vision was so fresh and new before people became institutionalized into all the integral forms that the committees had, when there was a complete differential visionary experience, one finds poignantly in the art of those earliest catacombs Whenever there is a major figure, a Moses or a Jesus or an Orpheus, whenever there is a major religious figure gesturing to the operative center of the vision, there occurs this Paleolithic star, the dot with the lines coming out from it. Now, no one recognized this as a Paleolithic star until the late 20th century. It was always taken to be a symbolic star, the star over Bethlehem for the birth of the Messiah, the star of the angel of the presence in the divine vision of Moses, the star of the mystical Hermes guide for Orpheus. But in the late 20th century, a French thinker who was at once a paleontologist, an archaeologist, and an artist, André Leroy Guérin, took a survey of all of the prehistoric Paleolithic cave art of France and Spain, and he took all of the abstract lines that appeared in all of these works and collated them together. And he found that when you brought them all together, that you could make a composition, which he called the Paleolithic star. That all the subconscious abstract marks in Paleolithic art garnered and put together constitute a recognizable archetypal figure. And it's the same star, it's the same Paleolithic star that occurs and reoccurs in the very earliest so-called Christian art, so-called Hellenistic Jewish art. And it appears exactly in caves, only instead of caves in the Dordogne Valley or caves in the river valleys in Spain, they appear in caves under the holy city of Rome, the eternal city of Rome. So that there's an alignment. So that art is so utterly honest that after 30,000 years, whenever men and women make caves for the ultimate transition from life through death to a new life, whenever that ritual scenario is integrally put there together, they come up with a very similar archetypal symbol, that visionary Paleolithic star that carries them through. And that if you look at that kind of star and you recognize that this is a star, this is an integral form, one sees that even the word star in Latin, we get the term asterism. That is to say, a constellation of stars into a figure, Orion, the Pleiades, Libra, Cassiopeia, whatever. These asterisms, these gestalts, are a way in which the integral experience of the body and the mind are transformed and resonated out into the heavens, resonated out into the night sky. And there we see forms which we recognized once belonged to myth, once belonged to the integral cycle of experience, and now belong to the differential cycle of experience. So that differential experience is radically different from integral experience. Integral experience is always the process by which the body, in its form, communicates to the mind in its form. The whole process of mythic experience, of the use of language, of the use of feeling, The whole process of experience is so that the mind and the body can get on the same page and go through the book together. There's that integration mode. But language in a differential sense works radically different from language in the mythic sense. Visionary language is quite different from mythic language. It used to be called magic language as opposed to tribal language. The language that the tribe uses to convey experience from their bodily existence to their mind existence, from the existential form of the body to the existential form of the mind, that language always is integral. It's always seeking to pull things together, to weave them together, so that this woven kind of language is characteristic of myth. And what it weaves together images that are aligned in strings of narrative. Those strings of narrative are the myths, those strands of story, those narratives, those discursive ways of talking, of telling the stories, of how these images came about, what these images are. And all of those strands of experience, those mythic narrative lines, are rooted in ritual and have their meaning there in nature. So that the power of experience on the mythic level is that nature nourishes the reality of the body all the way to the reality of the mind. And the mind, in a very integral way, it's the very principle of integration. The mind is able to be still because it's able to be at one with nature. It's able to be the center, the focus, so that all experience that one would have is one's own Paleolithic star coming to one's own mental stillness. And you can do that. Men and women have done that by the tens of millions. All of that is radically different from the way in which an artist works. An artist is not a tribal member. An artist in every instance is always what we would call an individual person. If you tune in on a radio and you hear a certain timbre and combination of instruments, you know it's Stravinsky. You know it's like a differential Baroque. It's totally different and yet related in its polarity to music by a Corelli or a Vivaldi or a Bach. Nevertheless, they're all artists and they all have an individual personal flavor. Once you get Bach, it doesn't matter whether you're listening to a toccata or a cantata. It's Bach. As Frank Lloyd Wright said, he grew up in a household where Bach and Beethoven were just there all the time. So that his whole mode of hearing was ordered musically. He's very talented musically. He could hear musical order. He could hear musical form. It led to his first real job. He walked into an office and the young manager in charge of the draftsman was humming a tune from a work that Wright knew. And his comment to him right away was, "So you sing?" Because he was in key and he was humming the tune, right? Right, hummed it back to him to show him that, yeah, I know that too. And the man said right away to him, the man's name was Cecil Carwin. This is in Chicago in the 1890s. In fact, earlier, 1880s, 1887. And Cecil Carwin said to the young Frank Lloyd Wright, he said, "Well, I see that you're a minister's son." And Wright said, "Yeah, that's true." And Carwin said, "Well, I am too." And he said, "Almost everybody in the office is too." He said, "You should fit in here." And Wright said, "Yeah, I should. I'm broke." Carwin said, "Well, how much money do you have in your pocket?" And Wright said, 20 cents. He said, "Have you eaten today?" And Wright said, "No, I haven't eaten today." "Did you eat yesterday?" "No, I don't. No, I didn't eat yesterday." And Carwin said, "Well, you better go in and get the job, and then you better come down with me, and we'll go get some food." And Wright went in, got the job. He'd been wandering around Chicago for almost the better part of a week. He'd gotten there with $7, and he was down to 20 cents. And if you don't eat, or you don't go anywhere, don't do anything, why, you don't spend any money, but you've run out of time. I know I tried it once at age 19 in San Francisco, and you go about 7 or 8 days without food, and you begin losing it. I mean, it's not like you panic or you go wild or something like that. It's that physiologically you notice that there are spots in front of your eyes because the cells are dying in the retina. That you don't sleep anymore because the body is so flattened out that it doesn't even respond to a cycle of sleep and wake anymore. And you realize that you're on the edge. That a little bit more, and that it's not going to be very nice to come back because you're going to be impaired permanently. Well, Wright was almost there. Not quite as stubborn as me, but almost there. He only went 4 or 5 days. When he got his first meal, it was browned corned beef hash, and he said, ever after in his life, whenever he became depressed, he would eat brown corned beef hash and would feel okay. He'd feel just fine. The way I came out of it, I found out that there was a tax refund check waiting for me in an East Bay city called Antioch, Pittsburgh, up by Antioch, Pleasant Hill, Walnut Creek. Only I had to get there. And I was so weak and so dazed that I realized that I had to hitchhike there, but there was the San Francisco Bay Bridge. And I was so far gone physiologically that I couldn't find a place to hitchhike because I couldn't find an entrance to the San Francisco Bay Bridge. There it was about 30 stories above me, and I couldn't find a way to get onto it. And it took me a whole day to find an entrance. And peculiarly, as soon as I did, I got a ride. But it only went to the other end of the bridge because they were going south to San Leandro. And so I got off and I had to walk. And I finally ended up walking all the way across the city of Oakland. It took a day and a night. And finally found an entrance to the freeway that goes through the tunnel that goes to the East Bay over to Contra Costa County. And I remember thinking to myself, I may die on the road. But I finally did get there. It's a beautiful thing. When I got the refund check, the first thing I did was I bought a pack of cigarettes. When you're 19, you're not very practical. You need something to calm you down before you get life. Wright, in his experience, was always attracted to the differential qualities of art. He never liked the integral saneness of doing things easy, doing things the way the tribe would say was right. He was a right which was different from being right. He was right. In fact, his autobiography begins with a very curious thing. His autobiography begins in a way that shows the difference between somebody who is integrally very sound, his Uncle John, and someone who is differentially very creative, Frank Lloyd Wright. Here's how his autobiography begins. Prelude. A light blanket of snow, fresh fallen over sloping fields, gleaming in the morning sun. Clusters of pod-tipped weeds woven of bronze here, there, sprinkling the spotless expanse of white. Dark splays of slender metallic straight lines tipped with quivering dots, patterned to the eye of the sun as the sun spread delicate network of more pattern in blue shadows on the white beneath. "Come, my boy," said Uncle John to his sister Anna's nine-year-old. Wright is nine. His mother's name was Anna. Here's his Uncle John. And Uncle John tells him that they're going to walk to this point on this bluff over there through the snow. And while he's walking in this dedicated straight line, so that when he got to the top of the bluff, he could with pride look back and see that his footsteps were a direct straight line. Wright's footsteps were all over the place because he was going gathering these beautiful abstract shapes of the pods of the weeds. And so he got to the top and the uncle castigated him. He said, "Just look at the difference between a man's tracks and your wandering." And Wright looked, but he saw the beauty of his tracks. That's why he begins his autobiography with that kind of statement. He always followed his own way. He was always an artist. He was always drawn to the differential mode. He would pay just enough attention to the integral mode to get things to where he could take off. The most integral that Wright ever let himself be was to live for 19 years in Oak Park, a suburb of Chicago, a western suburb of Chicago. Now you have to envision, Chicago was built right on Lake Michigan. But as Wright points out, did Chicago relate to Lake Michigan? Not at all. The railroads were built right next to the lake so that the rail lines, 50 or 60 wide, cut off the city of Chicago from Lake Michigan. The only thing that Chicago gets from Lake Michigan is a cold wind. Before Wright's time, there was no relationship of the city to the lake at all. Chicago was the city of broad shoulders built for industry, for no-nonsense profit-making. It was there because it was going to be the integral focus of all of the produce of the entire continent west coming together at Chicago and shipped out to the rest of the world from there. Chicago, of Frank Lloyd Wright's description, has a very peculiar and particular tone. I want to read you the opening description because I think it's, I've experienced Chicago in this way myself. Chicago. Wells Street Station, 6 o'clock in late spring 1887, drizzling. Sputtering white arc light in the station and in the streets, dazzling and ugly, I had never seen electric lights before. Crowds, impersonal, intent on seeing nothing. Somehow I didn't like to ask anyone anything. Followed the crowd, drifted south to the Wells Street Bridge over the Chicago River. The mysterious dark of the river with dim masts, hulks, and funnels hung with lights half smothered in gloom, reflected in black beneath. I stopped to see, holding myself close against the iron rail to avoid the blind hurrying by. Got onto the street again, finding it colder, raining harder. Drifted south, turned left, shivering now in front of the Chicago Opera House on Washington Street. He goes into the opera. Then he comes out. There were glaring signs on the glass shop fronts. Against the lights inside, sharp signs in the glare of the sputtering arc lamps outside. Hurrah signs, stop signs, come on in signs, hello signs, set out before the blazing windows on the sidewalk, flat fences lettered both sides, man high, hanging out across the sidewalks and lit by electric lamps. Coming from extravaganza, here was the beginning of phantasmagoria. Chicago in 1887. Wright had grown up in a very cultivated Welsh cul-de-sac of southern Wisconsin, a valley. His ancestors had come there, and they called it the valley. It was their valley, this beautiful little valley that eventually he built his first great home, Taliesin, there. Spring green. All the little towns around there have very plain names, hobbit-like names, Tolkien Shire-type names, just indicative of the place, spring green. He went from growing up in that kind of environment, he matured at the University of Wisconsin, when Madison was still a little tiny town, the only thing that was there were the two domes, the state capitol and the University of Wisconsin, separated by one long street, State Street, and the town on an isthmus in between two fairly large lakes, Lake Mendota and Lake Monona. The Capitol building set right in the middle of this isthmus between the two lakes, and the university wrapped around part of Lake Mendota. Towards the end of his life, when Wright wanted to really give a gift of vision to Madison, Wisconsin, he designed a huge terrace. The Monona Terrace Project was going to be several miles wide in this huge arc of modern buildings and everything going out over Lake Monona. And 37 years after he died, the city of Madison approved funds to build it, some 60 or 70 years after he designed it, and they're now building the Monona Terrace in Madison, Wisconsin, designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. So all of his great buildings are yet to be built. The buildings that were built in Wright's lifetime are only a fraction of the buildings that will be built in the 21st century. Wright was the kind of differential thinker that when people challenged him to build high rises instead of low prairie houses, instead of low buildings that gave this kind of rock ledge shelter, he designed a skyscraper that was 530 stories high, a mile-high building that was so huge and so expensive that no 10 construction companies could have afforded to build the thing. And he designed it like a huge tree with a taproot going down several hundred feet into the bedrock of Illinois. You can build very high buildings in Chicago because you have a lot of bedrock like Manhattan. You can really root a building. And nobody's built a mile-high building yet. They're a little squeamish after 120 floors. Wright was this kind of differential artist because he understood that a work of art, when it functions as art, opens someone up continuously. That instead of an integral experience is a differential experience. Instead of a mythic language that's spoken by the tribe, a work of art speaks a visionary language. It speaks a magic language that transforms. A magic language transforms in such a way that the youngest child exposed to the very first fairy tale understands abracadabra. No myth in the world ever had a word like abracadabra in it. Abracadabra is a magic word that transforms. A myth integrates, whereas a magic language differentiates. A magic language form is like the fairy tale. The fairy tale transforms. The fairy tale as a differential form does not integrate, but it opens out. And so the biggest dynamic of a fairy tale is at the end of it. Because the fairy tale, though it may be very short, it has an infinite resonance. And you can have a very large fairy tale, like Lord of the Rings by Tolkien. And its whole import, its whole thrust, is right at the very end. And the resonance of that point at the end is a point of infinite transformation. Everything is different forever. A fairy tale ends with the phrase, "and they lived happily ever after." The emphasis not so much on happily, but on the ever after, infinite life. So that a differential form opens out to the reality of the cosmos in its ever-evolving creative eternalness. So that the human person, as a differential form, is quite different from the member of the tribe. In fact, they are diametrically opposite and opposed. And Frank Lloyd Wright, as an artist, very early on, never made the mistake of trying to be a member of the tribe, a member of the clan, a member of the group. In fact, the whole family had this peculiar kind of tradition. They had a three-line, black-line symbolic figure, which was an old Druid symbol, and the motto was "Truth against the world." That if the world tells you that you're different from us, you tell them that's right. I'm the one that's right. You're all wrong. Truth against the world. Wright characterized himself, he said, "Very early on I had a choice between hypocritical humility and honest arrogance, and I've never regretted my choice." It's this kind of a quality that Wright had. He, when he built his first house in Oak Park, Illinois, Oak Park was known as Saints Rest because there were so many churches and quiet streets and houses that were just middle class at the time. Oak Park was not only the home of Frank Lloyd Wright, but his wife, Catherine, was best friends with Ernest Hemingway's mother, because Hemingway grew up in Oak Park, Illinois also. It was the western suburb of this terrible city of Chicago that faced the openness of the prairie, that had this feeling. One of the contiguous suburbs to Oak Park was called River Forest. So you had these nice tree-lined streets, the trees that arch over the streets and the branches intertwine. So you have these tunnels of beautiful trees, and you have all of these beautiful lawns and beautiful houses. And most of those beautiful houses that are there in Oak Park were built by Frank Lloyd Wright. He built dozens of fine residences in Oak Park. But the first house that he built in Oak Park was his own. His own first house. And he had carved on the wood lintel of the fireplace, "Truth is life." And he said as soon as the house was built and he saw that motto, he realized that it should have as well said, "Life is truth." But it was too late, it was already up. He built the first house because he got a loan to do it from his employer. Not his first employer, not Silsby, who had his Cecil Corwin as his manager. Wright worked there for a few months. And then one day, one of the men in Wright's office came in, a guy named Wilcox, and said, "Frank, there's an opportunity. They need a crack draftsman over at Adler and Sullivan, the big firm in Chicago. In fact, the big firm in architecture in the United States at that time. They were building fantastic new buildings. Adler, Dankmar Adler, was built like a tank. He was a hefty, Jewish, Germanic, charismatic engineer. Sullivan was the wild card gunslinging artist who could design fantastically, who could freehand draw in such an incredible way. He could draw this kind of floral ornamentation that looked like Celtic illuminated books freehand. But he didn't have time to draw all the stuff himself, and he needed an artist draftsman who could do this. So he went to Frank Lloyd Wright, went over to talk to Sullivan, and eventually he would get the job. But it was interesting to see how he began . I guess we have to take a break. Our machines just cut off. Let's take a break and we'll come back to how Frank Lloyd Wright and Louis Sullivan came together on the basis of arrogance. Here's Frank Lloyd Wright's recording of how he and Louis Sullivan had their first conversation. You have to understand, Wright is only 20 years old. And Sullivan is the top creative architect in the United States. "When Friday morning came, I had a lot to show. I got to Mr. Sullivan. I took the work out in order. He'd worked for 3-4 days till 3 in the morning making drawings." So he sets out the first ones. He says, "First, imitations of Silsby." His employer was a very good architect. "I see you've traced Silsby's designs to show me. They are not traced. I drew them. You see, they are not on tracing paper. But you might have had them transferred." I laughed. "Too much trouble." He looked me over with that glance of his that went clear through. Do you ever see a real artist at work? When they're at work. I saw a beautiful example at one time. The French government made a film of Marc Chagall. And Chagall was in this coop with all the pigeons and he was sketching them. And somehow the camera got behind the coop and in a zoom lens, they caught Chagall's eyes as he looked up from his sketching pad. And they just drilled through the film. Sullivan was like that, only he drilled with limpid brown eyes that took in everything, I mean detail, all the wrinkles in a pattern, indelibly. He had a photographic memory that instantly recorded all the tracery details exactly as they were. There are phenomena like that. Like Mozart would hear an entire symphony in its Baroque completeness before he write down a single note. We're talking about world-class artists. He looked me over with that glance of his that went clear through. "Second," says Wright, "imitations of Sullivan." "Well, you couldn't have traced those. Not half bad," he said to himself, scratching his scalp with the sharp point of his lead pencil. Do you get the subconscious? "Some white dandruff fell in the drawings. He blew it off. Third, improvised Gothic from Owen Jones." Owen Jones, who is he? I thought him joking. I said, "You know, the grammar of ornament, the world textbook of ornamental material." He looked puzzled. "Anything like Raguenet?" "I don't know Raguenet." "Oh yes, of course," he said. "I do remember the book. So you're trying to turn Gothic ornaments into my style just to please me, are you?" "Oh, yes, I said, "You see how easy it is to do that." And I saw I had displeased him. Unconsciously, I had reduced his ornament to a mere sentimentality. Fourth, here are some things, perhaps original, I don't know. He was immediately interested, said nothing. He was sitting on a high stool at his drafting board where he'd been drawing. And after looking over the drawings, he made no comment, but drew aside the cover sheet from his own board. I gasped with delight. Two geniuses facing each other, right? When two Zen masters look at each other, it's like two open doors. Here's Wright showing his fantastic artistic hand. And here's Sullivan showing his fantastic creative hand. And they were speechless. They'd both just knocked each other out completely. The upshot is, Wright got the job. First day in the office, he's sitting there. They assigned him a little table, a stool in front of a drafting board. Everybody else in the office kind of like sniveling at him. They didn't like him. It ended up in a couple of months in fisticuffs. He beat up the whole office. Wright was a toughie. But on this particular day, Sullivan came in, ignoring everyone casually, except Wright, the new man. "Hello, Frank." Went over to somebody else's drafting board, completely criticized it, said, "What do you call this?" And within 2 minutes, the guy had quit, broke his pencil, and left. 6 years later, Wright would do the same thing. He would just walk out. Frank Lloyd Wright's problem, as he says so very clearly in his autobiography, was that he was never able to stay within anyone's corral, no matter how large. He had done all the beautiful work for Sullivan on a 5-year contract. That's how he got the money to build his house. In fact, he went into Sullivan, he said, "I want to get married and I want to build a house, and I'm broke. And I can't get married because she's only 17. Her father won't give her to me unless I have some kind of security." So Sullivan called in his partner. He said, "Wright needs a 5-year contract." And Wright said, "By the way, I need to borrow enough money to build a house." So he got all of that. That's the way that they dealt. World-class geniuses like this do not waste time. They don't waste with the small stuff. They intuit immediately what's really essential, if something's going to go. And the process does not hinge on where it can go as an objective purpose, as a location, as a realization, but whether or not it's completely open, whether it can keep on going. What an artist looks for is, can it can just continue? Is it open enough to continue to do? That's worthwhile. One explores an open field. One is not interested in a closed field if it's fenced. If the landscape is the King Ranch in Texas, 1,000,000 acres, and it's fenced, the artist doesn't want to be there. He wants to be out where it's unfenced. He'll make his own world, thank you very much. The artist makes his own world. He makes his own realm. And curiously, nature moves over for an artist. She welcomes this kind of attention. Nature, because it's a process, because she is a process, she welcomes these advances. She welcomes the creativity of an artist who's making their own world. Is a female artist, Father Nature welcomes that she's making her own way. She's doing it her way, and nature recedes to the extent that that artist wants to make her way. One of the short films that we have is an hour-long film on Georgia O'Keeffe. Georgia O'Keeffe, who found a landscape that allowed her to grow infinitely the landscape in northern New Mexico. Once she got the feel for her infinite growth, she could then go and live in New York City for a while, and New York City welcomed her, but welcomed her as a natural place. She saw New York City skyscrapers as if they were buttes in northern New Mexico. She was not daunted by the fact that this is headquarters of World Corporation A. She lined up all the headquarters of World Corporations A through M and N through Z and made a moonrise or a cloud just above that canyon. In one canvas, she put a frame around New York City as a culture and opened it up as a work of art forever to anyone who could see, anyone who could experience, anyone who brought themselves there. In a way, a work of art is an altar of freedom, and you bring yourself there not to worship by some liturgy, but to open up the experience of the holy indefinitely. It's completely different. It's something that one cannot mistake. On the side, on his own time, Wright began designing houses because Adler and Sullivan built buildings. They built skyscrapers. They were the first to build tall buildings and make them tall. They had big commissions, the Chicago Auditorium, etc. They did not build residences, but they had rich clients who demanded sometime that they have a residence. They threw these crumbs to Wright. And so the young Wright, he's in his early 20s, started designing these houses. And his houses from the get-go were for the very wealthy, very cultivated, very particular. So Wright's sense of a house was that it was a complete world for such a differential person. He naturally saw himself in that way. His first house that he built was himself, for himself. And so the only way that he knew how to do it was to build a house as if he were that person, and he was building a house for himself as that person. Sullivan found out after about 5 years of doing this that Wright was building houses on his own for people that hadn't come through the office. And he demanded that Wright apologize for this. Employed by me. Wright said, I'm employed by you, but I designed for me. And left. And he never saw Sullivan again. He loved Sullivan. He called him Liebermeister, my beloved master, because it was the first time that Wright found someone who was like himself on his level. Sullivan wrote a series of architectural monograph sections that were gathered together, and they were gathered together as kindergarten chats. When you read through them, you realize what a fantastic level of intuitive genius that Sullivan had. But he called these kindergarten chats because he was talking to people who were on kindergarten level. They weren't ready to hear what a mature architect would say, and so they didn't get to hear it. Wright had a very similar kind of an arrogance, except that Wright, unlike Sullivan, was able to continually open and redo his personality. Sullivan ended up as a drunk alone in a hotel room, absolutely broken, friendless. Wright went through that phase maybe 10 or 12 times in his life and always emerged on the high side, always came back. Frank Lloyd Wright outlasted several deaths of himself in his life. He was dead, done, and finished. No one wanted to hear about Wright ever again, several times during his life. His own personal house, Taliesin, was burnt to the ground twice. One by a madman who murdered the woman that he was living with and going to marry and had fallen in love with, and murdered six other people that day with a hatchet. Wright survived every kind of termination. He was killed, he was forgotten, he was not acknowledged, he was thrown away, he was forgotten. But he always was there again. And when he finally died at 92, his office was as busy as it had ever been in his life, and he had new projects on the board that people had never even seen before. In the couple of years following his death, his office completed more architectural building than he had done in his whole life. The Marin County Civic Center, some of the other buildings around. Here's an example of Frank Lloyd Wright at the age of 34, writing on a very particular subject. It's called The Art and Craft of the Machine. He wrote this as a lecture that he gave at Hull House in Chicago, March 6th, 1901. Hull House was run by Jane Addams, A-D-D-A-M-S. Jane Addams was one of the great social geniuses, not a society woman, but a reformer. And Hull House was one of these great focuses in Chicago in the late 19th century. Jane Addams' genius of transforming the entire assessment of what society and human beings could be and were like. And she wrote a fantastic book on it, 20 Years at Hull House. Jane Addams was a frequent guest of Frank Lloyd Wright's uncle. So he delivered this in 1901 at Jane Addams Hull House in Chicago, The Art and Craft of the Machine. Here's the opening sentences. This was written and delivered 96 years ago. As we work along our various ways, there takes shape within us, in some sort, an ideal, something we are to become, some work to be done. This, I think, is denied to very few, and we really begin to live only when the thrill of this ideality moves us in what we will to accomplish. In the years which have been devoted in my own life to working out in stubborn materials a feeling for the beautiful, in the vortex of distorted, complex conditions, a hope has grown stronger with the experience of each year, amounting now to a gradually deepening conviction that in the machine lies the only future of art, and craft is, I believe, a glorious future. That the machine is, in fact, the metamorphosis of ancient art and craft, that we are at last face to face with the machine, the modern Sphinx, whose riddle the artist must solve if he would that art live, for his nature holds the key. 96 years ago. It's very difficult to appreciate at the end of the 20th century what a catastrophic challenge the machine was at the beginning of the 20th century. If one looks at the 19th century as a set of 10 decades and plots massively the strategic movement of human consciousness through the 19th century, I did it once about 15 years ago. I took more than 300 individuals of the 19th century and traced in order the wave of the evolution of consciousness through the 19th century. What one comes up with is a progressive dematerialization of the basis of conviction, At the beginning of the 19th century, in 1800, people were still convinced that real estate, property, was the foundation of society, and that things were what you had. And progressively through the 19th century, the development, especially of science, of physics and mathematics and art, led to the progressive dissolving of the certainty of those forms. Impressionistic painting, the Maxwell field equations of electromagnetism, and by 1900, 100 years later, the world looked as if there was no certainty in things whatsoever. And here, out of that quagmire of dematerialization, came the most threatening thing of all. An asymptotic Frankenstein. Frankenstein was a superman that challenged the world, but the machine promised a super world that challenged anyone. It's one thing to have a Frankenstein monster as a flawed super being that you could fight, the alien, the mutant. But how are you going to fight a whole planet that's become machine, a whole super civilization that ignores individuality? Wright was one of the few artists who stood toe-to-toe with this terrific specter and welcomed the challenge, whose drawings were of such a beautiful quality that they're held as works of art. This 12th volume of the Japanese publications of the works of Frank Lloyd Wright is all about the beauty of the renderings of Frank Lloyd Wright, about his incredible artistic talent and quality, of how in his renderings, if I can find one that will show on the camera, on the left is a simple little bridge that he designed and built. But look at the rendering. The qualities. Here's a warehouse building that he designed and built. The warehouse was built in 1915. Where did he get this? He had an innate sense of art. He had been raised from before birth. His mother hung the bedroom into which he would be born with prints of Gothic cathedrals. She prepared a world for him to come in where he would be the consummate great artist. He was trained to not only see and feel, but to sketch, to strategize, to not only dream, but to conceive and build. His mother was a school teacher, and she used a quality of education that was developed by a man named Froebel. And his whole education was based on a series of developmental qualities called the gifts. These were geometric primordial figures that were in primary colors. And it taught children to see in archetypal ways the fundamental shapes, the fundamental colors, whose geometry and geometricity and arithmeticity all were the basic structure of whatever images are going to align themselves. So he learned to build in his very perception. He learned to create in the very seeing, and the very seeing translated into the hands, which could do. So Wright could see and do immediately. He had such control over colored pencils that they were like samurai swords in his hand. There was no mediating thought whatsoever. He could spontaneously draw exactly beautifully, every single time, all the time. It's like the great haiku artist Basho. Basho's ancestors had been samurai who had used the sword, the magical sword, the sword made from bending metal 1,000 times, so that the thin sword had so many atomic layers of metal running every which way that it was strong and would whip itself. Basho trained himself to use the Japanese language in exactly that way and made the haiku poetic form. Wright used his drawing pencil, like Basho's genius used the haiku. In fact, Wright discovered a great affinity with himself and the Japanese. The inheritors of Basho in Japan in the 19th century were not poets, but they were artists, visual artists. They were Japanese printmakers. And the Japanese printmaker who began this was Hokusai. But Hokusai was improved upon by Hiroshige. Hokusai made Homeric kinds of lines, but Hiroshige transformed the Homeric lines of Hokusai into the color that was there in a genius, say, like Matisse or Monet or Renoir. Hokusai had the line, but Hiroshige had the color volumes that differentially birthed out of those lines. So Hiroshige has the dramatic lines of Hokusai, but he has the dramatic lines that fan out into the color volumes that make Hiroshige's Japanese prints one of the wonders of the world. In fact, the whole development of Impressionism in France is based upon Hiroshige. When you see photographs of the early Impressionist artists, when you see Monet in photographs, they're usually prints of Hiroshige on the wall. Hiroshige's prints were the taste of color reality that powered the Impressionist art movement. Gauguin, Van Gogh, all of them had collections of Japanese prints centered around Hiroshige, and so too Frank Lloyd Wright. When one looks at Hiroshige's deep enough, concentrated, complete enough, long enough, one can look up and look out at the world and see it through Hiroshige eyes. One sees that the moon rise over some California ryegrass slope and some kind of a building looks exactly like a Hiroshige print. Frank Lloyd Wright's renderings look like Japanese prints. He said once, "You can tell if a Japanese print is good because it looks edible." His renderings are edible. The colors, the forms, are like a Japanese print. You get a quality sometimes where a right rendering of a house is so beautiful that you can hardly stand the fact that you don't own it, that you don't have it. Here's one of his sketches of Falling Water before it was built. I have above me a Japanese print by Hiroshige. Look at that print for a second. You can see how completely simple it is. And yet, in the simplicity, there's a plasticity that juxtaposed color makes. If you look at a Monet, you will see that a Monet has this simplicity and plasticity also. That one is free to move every which way in a Monet painting. The same in a Hiroshige print. The same in a Frank Lloyd Wright rendering. The same in a Frank Lloyd Wright building. If you're in an unmodified Frank Lloyd Wright building and you gain a kinesthetic concentration of a still point, and then just let that still point move in response to whatever space it discovers itself in. You will move through that building in a symphonic way. One very easy experiment which you can do. If you take yourself to Northern California, to San Rafael, where the great Frank Lloyd Wright Civic Center is, stand still for a moment, any place in that complex. Record to yourself what you see standing still. Then, remembering that as best you can, indelibly, start to move at the pace of walking, which is about 2 miles an hour. Then take the kinesthetic sense of walking, and what you see will transform. Exactly what you had seen in a certain composition before, which was a composition, now lifts itself off the page and the composition becomes a ballet. What you see becomes, instead of a still photograph, a cinematographic, a kinematic movie in which you star. The building itself allows you to play. Frank Lloyd Wright's Marin County Civic Center allows you to play at the pace of walking. At the pace of walking, the building unfolds its wings and flies with you and carries you in a world that moves at the pace of walking. It's a building that cannot be seen in photographs. And if it were to be filmed, it would have to be filmed so that the camera moves at the pace of walking. Why? Because the pace of walking in a civic center was to write the whole archetypal proportion of why that building is there. It's there to serve people on the move. It's a civic center. It's not there as a monument to the politicians. It's there as a focus of exchange of the citizens in their own center. It's a roundhouse for all of their activities, their movement, symbolized by the pace of walking. If one takes another kind of indexing, Wright loved geometry. He'd played with the Froebel gifts since he was a child. He was a genius. Like William Blake, he could envision transcendental forms. He could learn to see, for instance, he could set his sight to see at an angle of 30 degrees. So that everywhere that he looked, he would see in multiples of 30 degrees. If you go to Dallas, Texas, the Kalita Humphreys Theater, the entire structure is built on angles of 30 degrees. And if you set your experience to be 30 degrees, and then you walk through the Kalita Humphreys Theater, it opens up like a Baroque composition, like a Bach cantata. Every single angle of every single thing is 30 degree multiples and plays with that. But there's another proportion working. Wright thought the average human height was 5 feet 8.5 inches. Men, women, all ages, that the average human height, so he designed his buildings with that kind of modular, always there, 5 foot 8.5. So that where someone would stand, where someone would sit, where someone would lean. They used to make a lot out of Le Corbusier's modular, the golden mean. Very few people have ever taken the time to index the proportion of Frank Lloyd Wright's structures on the golden mean of 5 foot 8.5 inches. It holds like the 30 degree angle, or some buildings are 36 degrees. Some buildings have multiples of 90, and towards the end of his life, the last decades, Wright began to design in terms of circularities, so that everything that he saw was in terms of circles and arcs. And one of the last tremendously important and unbuilt structures that are still outstanding, Wright designed some houses. This one designed in 1952 for Acapulco, Mexico. 1952 is 45 years ago. He's using circles and ellipses and has left straight lines behind completely. He built and designed an interior of Beth Shalom Synagogue to look like a crystal structure that one would have out of a vision, or the interior of the Johnson Wax Building out of glass tubings to give the translucent iridescence of color, so that you cannot tell what color walls are, because they're not any color, they're an iridescence, and because the iridescence is carried by glass tubing, as you move, as you sit or stand, the proportions scintillate, so it looks like a rainbow fire in the interior of the structure. This was built 1936, over 60 years ago. So when we come to talk about Wright, we're talking about a world-class artist who still is misunderstood and still misappreciated. But we're pairing Wright with Henry Moore. And Henry Moore is the founder of abstract sculpture. But the most important thing to immediately understand is that Henry Moore's abstract sculpture belongs in nature. He always took care that his sculptures, abstract as they were at home in natural settings. Not only the nature of parks and landscapes, but he was particularly challenged towards the end of his life. There was a great exposition held in the city of Florence, Italy. And Wright was very glad to have some of his sculptures displayed with the city of Renaissance Florence in the background. He was overjoyed. And while he was there in Florence, showing everyone that his sense of nature complemented his abstraction. I have a series of slides I'm going to show you perhaps next week or the following week. Wright went up to northern Italy to the mountain quarry of marble that Michelangelo had used, Carrara. And while he was there at Carrara, he had this very deep mystical experience, a kind of a Henry Moore mysticism. Not anything flighty, but something that became so eminent that he could literally lay his hands on blocks of marble like Michelangelo could do and feel the forms wanting to be released from within. Henry Moore's sculpture towards the end of his life, instead of working with forms that were fairly small, forms, sculptures, say, up to maybe 15, 20 feet, he began working with sculptures that were dozens, scores of feet across, and began envisioning sculptures that were large enough to be able to stand beside 100-story machine office towers, that they would be able to hold their own vis-a-vis any scale of modern machine civilization. So that Frank Lloyd Wright and Henry Moore are a pair of artists that stood toe-to-toe with the machine age, toe-to-toe with the mechanistic scale of power, toe-to-toe and winning in the way in which the challenge of a technocracy that would bury us forever if we stayed on the tribal level. When you can manipulate genes and molecules and atoms, tribal members have no chance whatsoever for health. You will be exactly as you were planned, as you were programmed. So that Wright and Moore also are protagonists of the artist as hero, T. taking on the dragon of technology, the dragon of the technological future that would turn everything into an alpha veal, into a HAL 9000, and dealing with it not to kill it, but to transform it. For one does not have to kill the dragon, sometimes you can tame it. When you tame the dragon, then you're able to ride. Like in Dune, when the great sandworms of Dune are tamed by the free men, then one is able to be at home on that planet. Or taking you back to the 1930s, when Alley-Oop is able to tame a dinosaur, then Denny becomes his friend and his ride. And he's able to have all kinds of interesting adventures. From Paul Maudib to Alley-Oop, it's a question of sometimes taming the dragon rather than killing it. This is a very Taoist way. Lao Tzu does not kill the Tao in order to have Te. Man does not have to kill the intuitive transpersonal in order to be himself. He doesn't have to squelch the monumental so-called unconscious in order to be real. All of this can be brought into play together. One of the most interesting books ever done on Henry Moore is by the great Jungian psychiatrist from Tel Aviv, Eric Neumann, published in the Bollingen series. It's entitled The Archetypal World of Henry Moore. And in it, Neumann points out that at the very root of Henry Moore's art is a relationship of mother and child. Mother and child in terms of sculptural forms. And very early on in his life, in the 1920s already, as having come from the Midlands of industrial class England, Wright grew up in a town where there were no trees. There were just dirty brick row houses, street after street of the workers in the mines. The largest structure in town was a slag heap. Moore came out of this, one of these kinds of solid, no-nonsense school teachers, kind of burly arms. He always favored dressing in dark blues, grays, maybe a little black. He almost looked like a Amish artist because his color scheme was steel grays, dark blues, blacks, and maybe a thin white pinstripe. And that was it. He liked combinations of that, and that was about it. But out of this came this inordinate sensibility that what was there was related to what is not there. That whatever form one sees, the context that one does not see, is related to it. Sometimes the form is the mother and the context of what is not there is the child. Sometimes what is not there is the mother and what is there is the child of what is not there. And he was shocked one time in the 20s. He saw a stone sculpture from South America, from Peru, of Chacmool, the rain god. You can see an example of Chacmool over here on Robertson Boulevard by the Ivy in front of one of those stores along Robertson. Chacmool is reclining, and in the center of Chacmool, where the Manipura chakra would be, is a big empty circle, emphasized because the rim around the empty circle is a big wide circle in stone set right there at the Manipura chakra, right there at the solar plexus. It's this space, it's this sculpted geometrical space that receives the first rain, that collects the first rain, and makes of Chacmool then the archetypal tribal symbol that the nourishing rains are going to be collected for man's life. And Chakmul is the rain god, ensures that. And in fact, in the Maya and Inca civilizations, rain was always one of the great mystical adventures of creativity. The rainmaking ceremonies were always of the utmost. Not the sun, but the rain. When Henry Moore saw Chakmul, he suddenly realized that the reclining woman was the recipient, creatively, of the entire space of the world. And in 1929, he made his first sculpture that incorporated this aspect. It was a reclining figure made out of brown Horton stone in 1929. I'll show you next week or the following week a sculpture on slide. Here's what Neumann reads. As we follow Moore's development, we shall see that it is always the two great themes of mother and child and the reclining figure round which his art enfolds. All other objects are only peripheral. They prepare, they illustrate, they elucidate what is going on in the central zone of the feminine. In other words, the reclining nude woman is ready to receive, and what she receives is an impregnation that results in further resonances of life, the child. He had in 1929 this concentration enough to see that when he made a mother holding a child like this, he immediately afterwards made a sculpture that had the mother holding nothing. And exactly where the child had been, there was a Chakmul-like cavern, circular space made. And that was the beginning of his seeing that a sculpture works with the surrounding space, and the power of a sculpture is how much of the surrounding space is brought into play, integral with the sculpture, and that integration of sculpture and space then resonated out differentially as the work of art. So Moore, like, one can hardly imagine another sculptor that had as much insight. Perhaps Rodin, who knows who else one could incorporate in that short list. Michelangelo, perhaps Donatello. The innate feel that the sculpture includes the resonant space, that the work of art is not just the stone or the metal or whatever the medium is, but the surrounding space also. And that the ability then of Moore as a transformational interplanetary artist on interstellar scale was to make sculptures so vast, controlling a space so huge that people appreciating him could walk through the space, walk through the sculptures, and become a part of it, that their kinesthetic balance and kinetic movement were a part of this sculpture. Real theater in the round, but done on a huge cosmic scale. Wright, towards the end of his life, made sculptural ensembles so large that whole groups of people could move and play within them, and they were part of the sculpture. He made sculptures so powerful that the space they included skyscrapers that were surrounding them. Like Wright, Moore was able to take the proportions of the machine age dragon and not only tame it, but make it a friend. Next week when we come back, we'll take a look. I'll see if I can bring some slides. I'd like to show you some images of Moore and Wright. What we're doing in our education at this point is also to bring your experience out of the integral into the differential form. And for this reason, you have made sculptures that you have exchanged with other people. And next week, you're to bring those sculptures that you have redone. And we'll again look at these sculptures and exchange them a second time, because what has been redone is going to be redone again. So that one can emphasize that this isn't redoing, it isn't revising, but it's creation by phase form differential opening up. One is not destroying a work of art or revising it or just recreating it, but one is extending the resonance of that original work into differential realms that were unforeseeable and unknown and yet actually now are going to occur. A sculpture which has not only been reworked once, but reworked twice, so that the reworking is reworked, is called an exponential curve that leads to infinity. The most popular way of expressing this was the title that George Gamow gave to a book on cosmology. He called it 1, 2, ... infinity. 1, 2, 3, infinity. Once you have that progression set up, once you have 3 in a line with an ellipsis to infinity, that expression holds openly forever. There is no way that it can ever be co-opted, truncated, frozen, ruined, because whatever happens on any scale in any dimension is artistically part of the experience of its reality. What do we say? We're saying that there is a threshold beyond which artistic man becomes free forever. That there is no possibility, understand this, there is no possibility for one's infinity to ever be co-opted ever again into some kind of version which imprisons. There is such a thing as life eternal. The hero as artist is actually a savior in the making. More next week, thanks.